Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. During the 2018 midterms, Democratic candidates promised gun control, or what they called gun safety, would be on their agenda if returned to power. And last week, the democratically controlled New Hampshire House passed two gun-related measures. One expands the types of firearm sales subject to background checks. The other creates a new waiting period of 7 days before a gun purchase can be finalized. Today in The Exchange, we focus on these two bills, the details and questions involved, also how they might fare in the state Senate and with the governor. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests in studio. With us is Joe Hannon, a board member of Gun Owners of New Hampshire, a former Republican state representative for Barrington and Lee. And Joe Hannon, nice to see you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Xander Rice Hawkins, executive director of Granite State Progress and Advocacy Group. And Xander, good to see you too, and welcome back to you too as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Xander, I'll start with you. What is not covered by background checks now? Let's start off with the background check bill. What types of transactions do you think should be covered?
Mm-hmm. So right now under the background check system, anytime a gun store dealer or federally licensed dealer sells a firearm, they have to conduct a background check. What goes unchecked are any private sales. So particularly our concern is around commercially advertised sales. So somebody selling a firearm that's advertised on the internet, maybe they step outside at a gun show, or they put up a classified, and they don't really know this individual they're selling a firearm to. That creates a really dangerous situation, and that's a loophole that we know that felons and domestic abusers and other prohibited persons use to access firearms that they should not have.
And a little bit later in the show, we'll hear from Ralph D'Amico. He is former owner of Riley's Sports Shop, so we'll get his perspective on it. But just to super clarify, Xandra, so right now, what are the guns that are subject to background checks?
Anytime you go to a gun store, you have to go through a background check, and that is both for handguns and long guns. But truly, we have a very large unregulated private market where people are exchanging or purchasing firearms between individuals with no sense of checks and balances.
So internet sales, gun shows, and so forth, those are not covered right now by the current background check system.
Not covered.
What do you think, Joe? How do you feel about this proposal to extend background checks to all commercial sales that Xander describes?
Well, first of all, it's not true that the background checks are not required at gun shows and online sales. They are required. Most of the people at gun shows are federally licensed firearm dealers, and they have to run a background check every time they sell a firearm. You're also not allowed to sell a firearm to someone who's not known to you. If you don't know them, you can't sell them a firearm. So even if you're online, if you don't know the person and you don't know that they're not a felon, you have to get a background check. So you can advertise online, but it's illegal to do that sale without doing the background check. So it really is not necessary to do this.
So online sales are governed by background checks? That's counter to what I have read.
Yeah. I mean, if you can do an online sale, but if it's especially out of state or even in state, if you don't know the person, you should be getting a background check. Now, could someone put an ad on, you know, before on Craigslist or something like that online and buy it without one? They could potentially do that, but it's not legal to do that. So it's not a loophole. There are people that are breaking the laws. And the fact that most people get their firearms for criminal purposes, not through legal means. They don't get them from gun shows primarily. The vast majority of guns that are used in crime are obtained through the illegal market. And one of the biggest ways that that's done is through straw purchases. Now, a straw purchase is actually something that it's legal at the point of sale, technically, because someone who's legally allowed to buy the firearm gets a background check and purchases it, and then they may give or sell that firearm to a family member, friend, or a gang member, or whoever they're giving it to. That's illegal. That is one of the major ways that people get firearms illegally, also through theft. And they can buy them on the street. And criminals aren't going to get a background check when they're buying it illegally on the street.
I definitely want to ask you about that, Xander. But just to super clarify, Joe, you said most sellers at gun shows, and we have them in Concord, for example, at Everett Arena, you said most sellers at those shows are federally licensed firearms dealers who need to do background checks. What about someone who owns 10 or 15 guns and just wants to sell them? Would they also have to conduct background checks, even though they're not an official commercial firearms dealer?
Anyone who's selling it for commercial purposes, if they're doing it as a business, they must do it for under federal law.
What about private person who just owns,
say if I wanted to sell you a firearm, I would not have to get a background check to sell you a firearm if I knew who you were and I knew that you weren't a felon. If you told me you were a felon, I couldn't do it. Now, it can be a little tricky that if you may not know someone's a felon, but someone could have a marijuana possession charge from 30 years ago that could preclude them. I might not be able to know that, but that's up to you. And if you are a prohibited person, it's a felony for you to purchase a firearm. So it's against the law. You can't buy it if you're a firearm. You can't possess it if you're a felon. And there are a lot of checks in place for that.
Xander, I want to hear from you on the point that Joe made, that others have made, that people who are going to commit crimes in general are going to get their guns illegally. They will steal them. They will get them through these straw purchases. That background checks really aren't going to make the public a lot safer.
I think the data shows that that's just not true. In the last 25 years, the federal background check system has blocked more than 3.5 million legal sales. So these are people
who nationally.
So again, those are felons, domestic abusers, others who should not be able to purchase a firearm, who have actually tried to do that, and the background check system has stopped them. And I want to clarify a couple of things, because words are really important in this. You heard when we talked about gun shows that Joe said, most of the dealers or most of the people selling at gun shows are dealers. That's not everyone, though, and it's certainly not required that the only gun store owners can sell at those gun shows. In fact, the shooters in Columbine were able to obtain one of their firearms at a gun show where they went around and cherry-picked whether or not they're going to have to get a background check for it. Same thing with internet sales. If you sell across state lines, you are supposed to go to a federally licensed dealer, either deliver it to that gun store or send it there for them to run a background check. But internet sales within the state do not have that same requirement. So it's really important we get into the specifics.
Joining us now on the line is Ralph D'Amico. He's former owner of Riley's Sports Shop in Hooksett, which sells guns and ammunition. Ralph has been active in the New Hampshire Firearms Safety Coalition. He's co-founder of the Gun Shop Project. That's a team of gun owners and public health experts that work to prevent gun suicides. And Ralph, thank you very much for giving us your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So right now we're talking about this bill, Ralph, to expand background checks to other types of sellers, as you had to do all the time as a gun shop owner. How do you feel, Ralph, about the idea of extending that requirement to other sellers?
Well, I have very mixed feelings in that I, for some 20-odd years, probably 25 years, participated in gun shows. I had sales tables and so forth at gun shows. And I will tell you, at least from a New Hampshire standpoint, there, in my opinion, was very little activity on behalf of outsiders coming in and trying to sell their guns to the general public. Dealers don't like it because it's competition. New Hampshire residents, for example, would be ill-advised, in my opinion, to purchase a gun from someone just running around a gun show with a gun for sale. I saw very little of it in my 20-some-odd years on the gun show circuit.
Gun control advocates have often talked in the past, as I'm sure you know, Ralph, about closing this so-called gun show loophole. You seem to be saying it doesn't really exist?
I believe it does not exist to a significant level, absolutely. And from my own observations, they would have you, in some instances, believe that there are just droves of people running around with guns for sale. And bear in mind, as Joe Hannon said, it's illegal. to purchase guns across state lines. It's a federal law. It is illegal for someone to sell a gun to someone they believe or know to be a felon or a prohibited person. And therefore, it's incumbent upon the seller to take certain measures to preclude this from all happening. There may be shows other places in the country where this type of activity is rampant, but I don't believe it's encouraged because, after all, dealers are paying good money to be at those shows, and they're in direct competition with these individuals, whoever they are, however many there are, selling firearms. And also, what I have seen in terms of the outsiders coming in to sell guns, they do go to dealers and attempt to sell these firearms to dealers. So I'm saying that I think the term gun show loophole is very much overrated, in my opinion.
I want to play a little clip while we're all talking about this from the hearing on this bill. This is Representative David Muse. He's a Democrat of Portsmouth. He's a supporter of this background check extension bill. He describes the loophole he sees that this bill, HB 109, seeks to close. Let's hear.
When an unlicensed private seller decides to sell a firearm and finds a buyer, the sale can often be completed in minutes with no background check required. What this loophole does in a state that doesn't act to close it is to make it possible for felons, domestic abusers, and other prohibited parties to obtain a weapon without going through a background check. All you need is to find a willing seller, and no matter what you've done or how many people you've hurt or threatened, you can get a gun.
Again, that's Representative David Muse talking at the hearing on HB 109 that would extend background checks to all types of commercial firearms sales. So back to you, Ralph, please. What do you think about what we heard from the representative there, that right now felons, domestic abusers can get a gun, they just have to find a seller?
Well, that's true outside of the gun show arena. I would dare say, by virtue of who they are, felons, criminals, they don't pay much attention to the law, apparently. I would say to you, to the public, that if given a minimal amount of effort, if I were to go to downtown Manchester and perhaps hang around some a few bars and start asking some questions, that by the end of the evening, I could purchase an illegal stolen firearm from some individual who's more than willing to sell it. So it's available to individuals who are motivated enough to get one. They don't have to go to gun shows. Maybe the gun show is a little bit easier because someone's walking around with a sign on a rifle saying for sale, perhaps. But firearms, illegal firearms, have always been easily available in the secondary market.
I'm wondering about internet sales, Ralph, and how you feel about background checks on internet sales, given that you can't see people face-to-face on the internet.
This is a good one, and because it's a big misconception here. You can contract and buy a firearm on the internet. However, the federal law requires that it be sent to a federally licensed dealer in your state of residence. Any seller on the internet who does not do that is open to federal prosecution, sending guns across state lines, and the dealer, of course, receives the gun for you and has to run a background check the very same as he would for any individual purchasing a gun from him. It's the same level of scrutiny. It's the same burden of responsibility. So internet sales direct from person to person are prohibited by federal law.
Because always it's across state lines.
Absolutely.
Or
anywhere.
It could be, yeah.
Yes. I mean, in the state of New Hampshire, for example, you cannot sell a handgun to someone you do not personally know. That's a pretty big prohibition. I mean, how many people do you actually know in the state of New Hampshire? Well, 100, 200. But that is that's the law, and you know we have all these laws in place. I will tell you, in my years in business, I have seen from time to time an unwillingness by a lot of law enforcement agencies, especially the federal ones, to enforce the laws that are on the books. It's disturbing.
Ralph, hold on just one moment, please. Xander Rice-Hawkins, I want to bring you back into this. Go ahead.
Well, there is a definition in New Hampshire state law, it's RSA 159.14, that does say you need to personally know the individual you sell the firearm to. Here's the catch. It doesn't say how long you have to have personally known that person in what context. So I meet you at a gun shop, and we walk outside and go to the car, and I've met you for 5 minutes. I can sell you a firearm. I go to arms list. I purchase a firearm online. We meet at a grocery store or parking lot. We've met. You can sell me a firearm. So there really isn't any teeth in that law. So we would say that that's a misnomer to say that that adds any protection. Now, you cannot sell a firearm to somebody who you know is a prohibited purchaser. But again, because we have this big gaping hole in the background check system, you really don't have any kind of, responsibility to ensure that that person is not a prohibited purchaser. So somebody who you casually know or you just met, you honestly do not know whether or not they are a prohibited person, and you sell that firearm, you're not liable for that. Whereas with under our background checks bill, you have a responsibility to make sure if you're giving a firearm to somebody that you know that they're not a felon or domestic abuser or other prohibited person.
What do you think about that, Ralph? The idea that saying you need to know the person, Xandra seems to be saying, that form of knowing can be, a five-minute conversation.
Well, in due respect, I think that's a play on words, and we're using semantics here. We've been on the phone with someone for 10, 15 minutes. Do we know that person? Of course not. You meet someone casually in a restaurant, and you strike up a conversation. You don't know that person. I guess it's the definition of the word know, and I think the spirit and intent of the federal law is that you are reasonably familiar with the individual and the individual's character. That's the spirit and intent. It does not mean that if you meet a person on the street, hi, how are you? I'm Bill, want to buy a gun. It's not within the purview of the spirit and intent of the law.
How much does a background check cost, Ralph, in terms of time and money to a gun shop owner?
Well, it varies. The federal background check is called an instant check, and it is, in fact, very quick. Other than filling out the form, which is a six-page form, the individual purchasing the firearm fills out the entire first page and a signature block on the second page. The dealer's representative continues the form, makes the call. I would say that the entire process takes between 5 and 15 minutes on the federal level. However, on the state level, because in the state of New Hampshire, all handguns have to be checked through the state. In this state, we have a little bit higher level of scrutiny for handguns. Why that is, I don't know. But on the state level, the form is filled out. The same information is transmitted to the individuals at the state. The state people hang up the phone, do their background check, and call you back. And that can take anywhere from, 20 minutes to 2 or 3 hours, depending on how busy they are.
And this gets us into what we're going to cover in the second part of our show, the idea of extending the waiting period from that point of purchase to that point of transfer. Ralph, we could have talked a lot longer. I'm going to let you go for now, but please join us again because this is really interesting.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That's Ralph D'Amico, former owner of Riley's Sports Shop in Hooksett, which sells guns and ammunition. Again, he's been active in the New Hampshire Firearm Safety Coalition. He's co-founder of the Gun Shop Project, which works to prevent gun suicides. We will be talking about extending the time period between purchase and transfer of a gun in just a moment. That's a subject of another bill. We'll also spend a few more minutes looking at this bill concerning background checks. Lots to talk about. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
A gift to NHPR through your estate plan is a wonderful legacy to leave for those who will need a trusted source for news. Hi, I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major and Planned Gifts for NHPR. As NHPR has inspired you to learn more about your state and your world, so too will your legacy gift inspire future generations. Email me at salger@nhpr.org to learn more about including NHPR in your estate plans, or go to nhpr.giveplans.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the legislature has looked at many gun bills this session. We are focusing on two this hour, one for a 7-day waiting period between a gun purchase and transfer of that firearm. The other that we're going to focus on for a few more minutes would extend background checks to all commercial gun sales. Let us know how you feel about these ideas. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Xander Rice Hawkins, Executive Director of Granite State Progress, and also with us, Joe Hannon, Board Member of Gun Owners of New Hampshire and a former Republican State Representative for Barrington and Lee. And an email came in from Steve in Milton, who says, background checks are fine in principle, but I don't want to have to go or to pay a shop. I'd like to directly interface with the check mechanism. Steve, thank you for the email. And Joe, to you, this has come up. People have said, okay, I'm at a gun show and there isn't someone there to conduct the background check, and I don't feel like I should have to go to a shop or pay a dealer to get that taken care of. What do you think?
I mean, if it's a commercial sale, you have to do that. But this bill does change the definition of what a commercial sale is, and I'll get to that in a second. But the fact that a private individual can't access the background check system is something that should be considered. If there's a way to do it anonymously, where someone could check in and find out, that may be an option, but it's not available right now.
I want to play a little bit more from the hearing on this bill. This is Representative Terry Roy. He's a Republican from Deerfield. He spoke against the bill. We heard a little bit earlier from David Muse, who spoke in favor. Here's Representative Roy saying this just raises too many questions for law-abiding gun owners. Let's hear.
So we can say you have to get a background check, but where are you going to get it done? It doesn't require that they be performed, so you have to actually hunt for someone to do it for you. It also doesn't discuss a fee, so I would imagine they can charge anything they want for this background check. This law is not ready for prime time. The citizens I represent do support background checks, and they would like to keep guns out of the hands of people that don't belong having guns. But this doesn't affect them. This just affects law-abiding citizens who are trying to transfer a firearm legally, be it for training or just to use.
Again, that's Representative Terry Roy, Republican of Deerfield, speaking out against this bill, HB 109, that seeks to extend background checks to all commercial sales. Can I hear from you too, Xander, about the idea of commercial sales, what that is, and whether this bill goes too far in terms of friend-to-friend transfers and making it too difficult?
Yeah, absolutely. And first, I'd say I don't think our organization would support having everybody have access to the background check system just for privacy issues. Those would be some concerns of ours. But this bill, House Bill 109, defines a commercial sale or transfers an exchange that takes place on the curtilage of a gun show or pursuant to
curtilage means what?
So if you were at the gun show, you met somebody and you went outside to the parking lot and sold a firearm without a background check, for example. And those are real examples from around the country that we've seen happen. Or if you offer to sell or buy a firearm from an advertisement posting, listing, or display. And really consider the fact that when the federal background check system was first put into place in the late 90s, implemented in the year 1999 here in New Hampshire and other states, the internet sales weren't really a thing at that point. And now, of course, they have exploded, particularly in the gun market. And if you go to arms list on any given day, you can see a number of firearms for sale in New Hampshire that do not require a background check. So it is important that we look at those loopholes. You know, it was mentioned earlier about the friends and family piece. I think we've done a really good job in New Hampshire over the years of refining this bill so that we have a reasonable exception for transfers or sales between friends and family. So the gun actually has to be commercially advertised. So if you are at a shooting range with a friend and you pass them your firearm because they want to try it out, or you know, something's happening with theirs, or if you loan it out to a friend, that's totally fine under the state bill. But if you do not know if that person is prohibited from having firearms or not. We do build in a penalty because we do, again, want to make sure we're closing all these loopholes. And if you don't know somebody well enough to know whether or not they're prohibited, possessor of firearms, you really ought not to be giving that. And that's just a responsible, common sense provision.
I want to ask you one more question, Joe, mm-hmm. about this bill, and then switch gears to the other bill that we're going to talk about today. That would place a 7-day waiting period between the purchase of a gun and transfer of that gun to the new owner. But one more question about this background check system. There does seem to be some concern about internet sales, that you really can't keep track of that. I just wonder what you think about putting a background check system somehow on the internet, or is that impossible? It's just too difficult. You can't control the internet.
Well, I actually agree with Zandra that there are a lot of privacy issues that are to be considered. So, if there was a way to do it possibly anonymously, I think that would be good. But I think that's almost impossible to do. It sounds good in theory, but in practice, I think it would be very difficult. The fact that the commercial sales are, anything that's, like I said, it's expanded the definition. So something pursuant to an advertisement, posting, listing, or display. Some people that might not be, familiar with firearms don't realize that a lot of places, at clubs, private clubs even, they might have a bulletin board with, firearms for sale. And these people might have known each other for years. But because there might have been a little flyer on their private club, they have to get a commercial transfer. And the transfer, people say it's innocuous, it doesn't really do anything. It's money. It costs money to do. And we don't institute extra costs on other rights that we have. We don't tell people, we should have it. We don't have poll taxes. We don't say people have to, pay extra fees before they're allowed to write a book or publish on the internet. So, it's something that I think is it's a very slippery slope to expand it so drastically. And to say that transfers between private individuals are not going to be affected is questionable.
I have an email here from Adam in Portsmouth. He says he's a gun owner. He says, I'm confused why gun dealers would be against this bill. If anything, wouldn't they want this bill? So business must be driven through their shops. If it's already a law and it's not an issue, why is it so bad to make it official? Adam says, I'm a proud gun owner and don't see why other gun owners would care about this bill being passed. Adam, thank you. And Joe, what do you think?
This is only going to affect law-abiding citizens. Criminals aren't really concerned about the avenue that they get them, and actually, they're not required to disclose. They're not required to even fill out the form. By law, there's a Supreme Court case, Hayes v. U.S., that says convicted felons can't be asked to perjure them, asked to imply and use incriminating evidence against themselves. So they have to fill out the form that says, "Are you a convicted felon?" They're not even supposed to fill out the form. If they do it, they're actually committing a felony. And one of the main reasons that people are prohibited or denied from the background check system is because they're prohibited persons. There were well over 100,000 denials in 2017, and the ATF investigated about 12,000 plus of those cases. And the United States Attorney's Office only prosecuted 12 of those well over 100,000 cases of prohibited persons committing a felony to try to buy a firearm. So the people that are already going through the background check system that are getting caught being felons who are already breaking the law again are not being prosecuted to any degree whatsoever. 12 out of over 100,000 is just ridiculous.
So what's the broader point that you're trying to make with those numbers, Joe?
The fact is that we have a system that isn't even enforced. So if people are using the background check system, we may think that it's keeping a firearm out of their hands temporarily, but that's still a person who is a known prohibited person, possibly a felon, who is actively trying to purchase a firearm. It's like saying someone who's trying to buy legal prescription drugs and they get turned down because of the monitoring system in the state, and then they go and buy them on the street. That's very common. And to think that that doesn't happen with firearms is just irresponsible. We have to the elephant in the room are the people that are using that are buying firearms through illegal means like straw purchases and theft and things like that. This accounts gun shows account for well under 1% of guns used in any kind of crime.
So this is where we shouldn't be looking, Zandra. Joe and others have said, look, again, criminals are going to find guns no matter what, and the background check system is not really the right place to sniff.
I'd say that, they talk about a big, the criminals will find firearms anywhere, but let's be honest, we are leaving a big gaping hole. criminals don't have to work to find firearms. They can go walk down the street. They can go online. They can access these firearms in very easy ways because we've left this huge hole in our background check system. Going back to the gun stores and how they would interact with this, and I want to thank the caller, Adam, for his question because he brings up two really good points. One is the state bill builds off of the system that's already in place for internet sales across state lines, or somebody goes to a gun store already to purchase a firearm. So that background check system is in place already, and if you were to sell a firearm over state lines, that is the process and the fee that you would pay already. So we're just expanding upon that to close that background check loophole. More importantly to the point is, the question really flags something we've known to be true for quite a while, and that is public opinion and will is on the side of closing background check loopholes. The public wants to see us take measures to increase public safety, to reduce gun violence. 9 out of 10 Granite Staters in polls for the last 6 years have said that they want us to close background check loopholes. Over 90% of Americans across the country, and this includes large swaths of Democrats, Republicans, independents, gun owners, who all agree that this is a reasonable common sense piece, and we really need politicians to stop blocking these efforts and get on board because the public has been there for quite a while.
Let's take another call. This is Marion in Warner. Hi, Marion. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I guess my question is, a gun is a big purchase. It can cause serious harm, it does, in our society. So if you are purchasing a gun for upstanding reasons, I don't understand why the idea of a, you know, a quick to a 20-minute background check is so egregious. I think of volunteering at my church, of volunteering at my children's schools, in both of those processes, I had to go through fingerprinting and background checks. Any job I've ever applied to, I've had to have a background check. I guess I don't understand why this would be so different. And even granted, the woman speaking is saying this is a problem. The gentleman, I feel like he's communicating, it's really not that big of a, you're not talking about the right population, we're focusing on the wrong population. But even the 1% number, if it's a large number of gun incidents, 1% could still be serious, especially if there's a fatality in that less than 1%.
Okay, Marion, thank you for the call. And what about that, Joe? Many of us who volunteer in our communities have had to go through extensive background checks. I volunteered with an organization a couple years ago and had to go through 2 hours of training and all sorts of background checks because I was working with children. So Marion seems to be saying, what's the big deal?
Well, it's not just a 5 or 10 minute check. I mean, people will also have to go to the firearms dealer and actually have the check performed there. You have to fill out a form. You have to wait. And, you know, if you purchase a firearm at a gun show and you have to wait, and we're going to get to waiting periods, if you have to wait 7 days, you're going to have to make a second trip. You know, if we talk about voting and how we want to make voting as easy as possible. But if you, if you were told, okay, you can vote, you can come and register to vote today, you know, pay your fee to vote, and, you know, whatever that the equivalent of a background check fee, and then come back in 7 days to actually cast your vote, make a second trip, take another afternoon off from work, that's not an inconvenience. It's something we have to do to make sure that you're a legitimate voter who should be able to do it. That's ridiculous. We wouldn't accept that whatsoever. So, this is basically a right delayed is a right denied. You know, if you are saying you have to wait for it, you're actually making things harder to exercise that right.
The voting analogy maybe doesn't fit because voting only concerns me, whereas if someone has a gun, they could potentially go out and shoot 50 people.
Well, I think people would disagree that voting doesn't just affect you. It affects
everybody. Well, there you go. Does have an impact. I understand what you're trying to say there.
We've gone to war for voting, so it affects a lot of people.
Go ahead, Xandra, and then I really do want to switch gears to talk about the 7-day waiting period bill, but go ahead.
Let's talk briefly about some stats we haven't talked about. 125,000 people shot a year, over 36,000 fatal shootings, and we all know about the mass shooting tragedies. So we're talking about public safety, and if folks need to go back to the purchaser a second time to make sure that we're keeping guns out of the hands of felons, domestic abusers, and other prohibited persons, then I think that that is something that the public has clearly said, yes, on the side of public safety, that we think it is worth taking that time.
Let's bring another voice into our conversation now. I want to invite Ken Norton to the show. He is executive director of the New Hampshire chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ken, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Good morning.
So we're talking to you this morning about another bill that we want to discuss, and that is the bill that would put a 7-day waiting period between the actual purchase of a gun and the transfer of that gun to its new owner. You've spoken in favor of this. How come?
Well, the conversation thus far is really focused on guns and gun violence directed at other people or crimes. And we spoke in favor of it because of its relation to suicide. And about half of the suicide deaths in the U.S. and 49% in New Hampshire in 2017 involved use of a firearm. And we believe that putting a little bit of time between the purchase of a firearm can help save lives.
How does the extra time help, Ken?
Well, oftentimes people may contemplate suicide for a long period of time, but when they actually decide to act on that, it can be a relatively short period of time. Ralph D'Amico, who was on before, who co-founded the Gunshot Project in New Hampshire, that project came about when there were three suicides within 11 days. Where each of those individuals, unknown to each other, had purchased their firearms from the same gun shop within 24 hours of their death. And, you know, that information was sort of coincidentally found in the investigations, a receipt was found, and it indicates that oftentimes the impulsivity relative to firearms. And, you know, one of the things that we know is that people who attempt suicide and survive, 90% of them go on to live and not die by suicide. But when firearms are involved, there's there's very little opportunity to intervene and save lives, unlike every other method of suicide.
So 99% of people who survive a suicide attempt, Ken, don't go on to die by suicide. So 90%. I apologize.
Yeah.
So is there something about surviving that first attempt that makes people decide not to do it again?
Well, I think that a lot of people, I mean, what research shows is that people that make even highly lethal attempts report being very ambivalent at the point of making that attempt, that they want the pain that they're in, the psychic pain or whatever pain, to stop, but they're not sure that they want to die. And I think certainly we hear from lots and lots of people who have attempted suicide who have gone on to get help and lead productive lives. And there are many, many more who are silently living in society who have attempted suicide and are our friends and family and neighbors.
Well, Ken, stay on the line with us for a moment because there's a lot more to talk about with this. But, Zandra, I want to bring you back in and you too, Joe. Just describe for us briefly, Zandra, what this bill would do, the specifics.
Yep. So the bill would create a 7-day waiting period, and it would does two main things. So the first is to provide a cooling off period to help guard against acts of violence, especially suicide, as Ken mentioned. And the second is to give law enforcement officials sufficient time to properly perform a background check on purchasers. And this is a really important provision to close what's known as the Charleston loophole. So under federal law, a licensed dealer can proceed with the sale of a firearm after 3 business days, even if the background check hasn't been completed and there's no confirmation that the purchaser is legally allowed to purchase that firearm. And that is the loophole that the shooter in the Charleston tragedy used and unfortunately shot up a church prayer service.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. I'll definitely bring you into this 7-day waiting period discussion as well, Joe. And Ken, we'll go back to you. We'll also take a lot of your calls. If you're on the line, stay there. We'll try to get to you. 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, too, if you'd like. It's exchange@nhpr.org, and we will be right back.
Hi, I'm Deb Turner, NHPR's Vice President for Development. Thanks if you contributed during the recent fundraising campaign on NHPR. Thousands of listeners generously gave in support of credible, accurate news coverage. Your support is critical in order for NHPR to thrive with independence and stability. If you didn't have a chance to contribute, there's still time to join us. Make a simple gift of support. Keep NHPR strong for you and future generations. Go to nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, Democratic presidential candidate John Delaney is here. Send us your questions for the candidate before the show to exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour, we're looking at two bills, both focused on gun purchases in the state. One involves a waiting period and another extending background checks to all commercial gun sales. Let us know what you think. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Joe Hannon, board member of Gun Owners of New Hampshire, a former Republican state representative for Barrington and Lee. Xander Rice Hawkins is also here, executive director of Granite State Progress. And with us on the line for a few more minutes, Ken Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And all of you, we've been talking about this proposed 7-day waiting period. Ken talked about it as a method to reduce the high suicide rate here in New Hampshire. And Ken, I want to share an email with you and get your thoughts. Joe, you too. Kevin in Lancaster wrote in. He says, most people buying guns already own or have access to other firearms. I dealt with 7 suicides by gunshot in 18 months. One was a close family member. Kevin, I'm so sorry to hear that. 6 were former or retired military and or law enforcement. 6 had lifetime access to multiple firearms. Only one could be called impulsive, and he broke into a neighbor's gun case and stole the gun he used. The others were all planned for days, weeks, or even years. No checks or waiting period would have affected any of them at all. Kevin, we're very sorry that you've had to cope with that. That's a heavy burden. And Ken Norton, to you first, what do you think? Kevin seems to be saying none of these rules would have made a difference.
Sure. Certainly, access is really the key question here, and it isn't just so not just purchase. But there are people that it is spontaneous for, and some research has shown that there's a reduction in suicides in states that have 7-day or have a waiting period, not necessarily 7 days, and a reduction in the overall suicide rate as well. So not just a reduction in the firearm suicides, but in the overall rate. One of the things that I would mention that's really problematic is that we don't really have good research, and we don't have good research because of the Dickey Amendment, which passed Congress in, I think, 1996, which prevented the U.S. Center for Disease Control, which addresses public health issues in our country. I'd like to think that we could all agree that any type of gun violence is a public health issue, from doing research on gun deaths. And as a result of that, we have really limited research about the effectiveness of some of these things.
Well, Ken, last question. I know you've been really involved in this. What are your expectations for what might happen with this 7-day waiting period bill?
Well, I think that what's really important is that we're having good dialogue about these issues, and I hope that part of that dialogue is that we focus on suicide as a public health issue in our state. And I certainly would hope that anybody that that is contemplating suicide or worried about a friend or a family member would call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and that number is 1-800-273-8255.
And if people did not catch that number, we definitely have it on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Ken Norton, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Joe, I'd like to get your thoughts, too, on Ken's concerns that this 7-day waiting period might help reduce the number of suicides that we have seen by guns.
The fact that it might help is something that we are discussing. And there are a lot of studies that have been done in the past, and I'm sure Ken's aware of them, that looked at the states that had waiting periods versus states that didn't and what happened after they did implement them.
So we do have some data.
There's some data. It's been out there. There's some that's been out there for a while, and there's more recent. There's a recent study. But a lot of the past data didn't show any significant change But there were I will say that there was a change in people. I believe it was over the age of 55 had like a 9% reduction or something along those lines in suicides in those areas. But generally, it didn't really have a big effect. Even the recent study that showed that it could possibly save a few hundreds of lives out of those 36,000 deaths that are attributed to firearms in this country, 2/3 of which, by the way, are suicide. So the vast majority of the firearms related deaths we're talking about are suicide. It's even a higher percentage in New Hampshire because we have a very low homicide rate. But even the author of that study said that further research, it suggests that it's a possibility, but further research does need to be done. So even the author of the recent study does think that it's not conclusive. It's correlation. The fact that we're overlooking what can happen if we delay someone's ability to access firearms, someone who's being abused domestically or stalked or someone who's been threatened. That person now will have to wait 7 days or longer because holidays and weekends are not counted in that 7-day period. So it could be up to 9 days or longer waiting period, which would be the longest waiting period in the country. And also, there was no, like Ken said, that with the studies that did look at it, didn't say it had to be a certain period, just as any waiting period would have done what they said.
I want to talk a little bit about what you mentioned, Joe, the idea that vulnerable people could be put at risk by this 7-day, possibly 9 or 10 or 11 day waiting period, depending on the weekend. At the hearing on this bill, State Representative Abigail Rooney, Republican of Milford, voiced concern about this, saying she felt this waiting period would put herself as a woman at risk and also her two young girls. Let's hear.
Guns are the great equalizer, and I have a right to defend my life and the lives of my children anytime, any place, and by any means necessary. We all do. That right is constitutionally protected, and nothing should get in the way of it, including a waiting period. That kind of infringement can cause a serious risk to someone who's facing an imminent threat. Perhaps someone who's dealing with a stalker, a victim of domestic violence, someone who's been receiving death threats.
So, Zandra, the bill does make some exceptions for hunters, active duty military, and law enforcement in terms of this waiting period, but I didn't see any for the scenario that the representative mentions. Also, I didn't see anything for, unfortunately, we've seen this rise in white supremacist attacks on Muslims and Jews and African Americans. So a minority community might not want to wait 7 days if it faces a specific threat against a mosque or a synagogue or a church. What do you think? What about these more vulnerable groups who don't want to wait that long?
Yeah, and I think, it's a good question to ask, but the reality is that we know we have an epidemic of gun violence in our country, and we need to weigh what the statistics are and what the odds are of these different scenarios. And in all honesty, going back to the earlier conversation, closing background check loopholes so that those individuals who have a domestic violence history and are abusers have less access to obtain firearms or other methods of tormenting their victims, that is one thing that we can do to help with that. But in general, the waiting period is a very important tool. We've seen where it has given law enforcement more of an opportunity to finish those background checks. We've seen where in states that have had waiting periods that suicide has gone down. The American Journal of Public Health has published studies to that effect. And we've also seen that in states where they've repealed that they've had suicides increase in the year following the removal of that waiting period. So we believe that this is a reasonable provision. It falls in the middle of the timelines that other states that have waiting periods have.
Is there
implemented
a middle ground, Zandra, where you might be able to meet in the middle with people who are concerned, like Representative Rooney, about women and girls, for example?
I think that the number one way for somebody who's in that situation to seek help is frankly to get the domestic violence restraining order and to go to law enforcement and make sure they're taking the steps that the domestic violence coalitions can help them to get out of that dangerous situation.
Go ahead, Joe, and then back to our callers.
I mean, it's not very easy to carry a police officer around with you all the time, so I don't think that's really an answer to a victim of domestic violence or someone who's afraid for their life, especially in the case of imminent danger or could be imminent danger. The other thing is this we're not paying attention to. We've had a huge increase in suicide rate, not just in New Hampshire but nationally. I think it's over 30% or 33% increase in suicides nationally over the last many years. So when states have had repeals of waiting periods, suicide rates were already rising. So if you're going to say that rates rose after you repealed a law and they were rising everywhere anyway, that's not really fair.
Let's take another call. This is Darlene in Hopkinton. Hi, Darlene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. I just wanted to mention, Ken Norton mentioned the 49% youth suicide rate in New Hampshire. My son's friend, who graduated from Hopkinton, died by suicide in October. 2 weeks after that, my own son became so sad at the death of his friend that he was going to pawn his Xbox and video games and even his phone to buy a firearm. He's 19. There was nothing that I could legally do to stop him. We called the police. We called the state troopers. We tried every means, even through the court, but there was no law in place to prevent him from buying a firearm. So the only thing that could have really helped him is a waiting period. What we had to do is we had to actually restrain him, keep him in the house, and then call the emergency services and utilize community supports. Now, if this was my 13-year-old daughter trying to get a firearm to commit suicide, there are no children's mobile crisis units for her to prevent that suicide. But luckily for my son, he was so intent on buying a firearm, his community mental health agency intervened and was able to de-escalate the situation. But had I not been home to see what he was doing, my son would be one of that statistics of the 49% suicide rate.
Wow, Darlene, I'm so sorry to hear that this happened to you.
Thank you.
Given your experience, it sounds like you are in strong support of this 7-day waiting period.
Absolutely. It's critical to save lives in New Hampshire.
Thank you so much for calling, Darlene, and very best of luck to you with your son. What a powerful story. What do you think, Sandra?
You know, the reality is that people who are contemplating suicide often contemplate that for less than 24 hours. We know it's an impulsive act and that waiting periods can save lives by providing just enough buffer time between when the person has that impulse and when they act on it. And guns are a uniquely lethal form of suicide, and that's why it is important to take steps.
Well, and Ralph D'Amico, who we spoke to earlier, again, has been involved in that gun shop project, a team of gun owners and public health experts working to prevent gun suicides. And many gun shop owners have told us, as we were getting ready for the show, that they would never sell a gun to someone who was distraught, who'd been clearly abusing substances and so forth. Joe, what do you pull out of that terrifying story that Doreen told us?
It's heartbreaking. I'm very sorry for what could have happened and did happen to your son's friend. But, you know, your youngest daughter would not be allowed to buy a firearm. Your 19-year-old son would not be able to buy a handgun.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I thought the age of gun purchases was 21 in New Hampshire, except for military.
Long guns, you can buy a rifle at 18.
I see.
But
okay.
You can't buy a handgun until you're 21. So, and then the vast majority of suicides are committed with handguns. So, you know, I'm not saying it couldn't have happened, but it's not as easy, it's not as clear cut as what it sounds like.
So if Darlene's son had gone into a gun shop and asked to buy a handgun, they would have looked at his driver's license and said no.
Pretty much.
Because he's 19.
Yeah.
But still, her point about having 7 days would be critical for someone in her situation. I just wonder what you think, Joe.
You know, the having to wait, you know, for someone who's, we're basically balancing one risk against another. So if someone, people have been killed waiting after getting a protective order that did not work. There was a woman in New Jersey who was killed after getting a protective order against someone who was after her, and she didn't get her firearm in time and she died. This does happen. There are many defensive uses of firearms. So we don't look at something, if a firearm is used in defense where it's never even fired, which is the vast majority of defensive cases, those stats we don't look at. We don't say how many lives are saved. And we know from the low estimate, it's, you know, hundreds of thousands to over 2 million defensive uses of firearms that are used. So could this help some people with suicide? It may delay or keep some people from doing it at a point. But if we're looking at the overall good we can do with suicide prevention, there's a lot more bigger fish that we can go after that are much more significant. You know, we have 1 in 6 Americans are on a psychiatric drug. You know, 1 in 3 Americans are prescribed a prescription painkiller. You know, most of the people that commit suicide have, I believe it's around 80%, have some kind of substance like that in their system at the time of suicide.
So you're saying it's more complicated than just the firearm.
This is far from a panacea. This is taking a small, very small percentage of a very large pie, and we're neglecting to look at why the rates have increased.
Well, and I'm thinking we have done many, many shows on suicide and suicide prevention, and I'm thinking given the numbers that you and Ken Norton are talking about, we should probably take another look at that again. We did put the suicide hotline again on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, so I really encourage people to access that if they feel that a loved one or they are in trouble. Xandra, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, certainly we would advocate for any additional resources towards suicide prevention, mental health, you know, substance use disorder treatment, because those are certainly issues. But when you look at the numbers in across the nation, and particularly New Hampshire, about suicide and firearms, there's a very deep cross-section. It's very important we address it. I also want to bring up, in terms of domestic violence situations, because I think there is a misconception here about the reality of the role guns play there. A woman or a victim, I should say, is 5 times more likely to be killed in a domestic violence situation with the presence of a firearm, and that does not matter whether the firearm was present because of the abuser or because of the victim. The presence of that firearm does lead to more lethality in those domestic violence situations, and so that's really important to be aware of as well.
Focusing specifically on these two bills, and hard to believe we only have a minute left, and it's gone really fast. On the first one, again, regarding background checks to all commercial sales, what's your sense, Joe, of how the state Senate might vote on this and what the governor would do?
Well, I have a feeling that, you know, the governor's stance on this has been clear. He said it in the past. Our gun laws are fine in this state. We are one of the safest states in the country. We have lower homicide rates than, you know, most of the rest of the country, lower than Canada as a whole. And even, you know, we're lower than London and Great Britain. So, you know, the governor, I have a feeling, will veto this if passed. It's already, you know, it's gotten through one committee in the House. I think it probably will pass again, but it didn't pass by a veto-proof majority, and I think the same thing's going to happen to both bills. They're possibly going to pass the House and the Senate, and then they will be vetoed and they will be upheld.
What do you think, Xandra? Same prediction?
You know, in a 2016 gubernatorial debate, Chris Sununu said that he'd support closing background check loopholes. We expect him to fulfill his campaign promise, and he's made suicide prevention and awareness a cornerstone of his administration's term this session, and waiting periods are supported by all of those advocates, and so we'd expect him to support this tool as well.
All right, both of you, not an easy topic. I very much appreciate you both coming in and talking to us about this. Johannan, it was good to see you. Thank you for your
time.
Good
to see you again.
That's Johannan, a board member of Gun Owners of New Hampshire, a former Republican state representative for Barrington and Lee. Xandra, good to see you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Xandra Rice Hawkins, executive director of Granite State Progress and Advocacy Group. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. And remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and Ali Oshinsky. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.